Warren, I'll be back with today's talking point. Here's how it sounded last night in Ferguson, Missouri.
You must disperse immediately. This is no longer a peaceful protest when you try to injure people. You must disperse now.
Police officers dressed like soldiers used tear gas to break up the latest protest over that police killing of an unarmed black man last Saturday. It's another dramatic demonstration of a trend in local law enforcement in the United States. Radley Balco blogs for the Washington Post. He's also author of Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Forces. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Does it appear, despite what we heard from the man on the bullhorn, that there was, in fact, a violent situation breaking out or that a major force of the kind that was available there was really necessary?
Yeah, I think we've seen this a lot. Going back to the very first protests over the Michael Brown shooting, which were completely peaceful, and that the police met in full riot gear with an armored personnel carrier, including a sniper perched on top who had his gun pointed at protesters. You know, this is when police respond to peaceful protest, expecting confrontation, when they, you know, sort of dehumanize themselves by wearing masks and shields and riot gear from the very outset, in some ways, it becomes kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. You get confrontation when you go in expecting it.
Has this happened? Has there been situations where policemen have said afterward, "I wish we hadn't done that"?
Well, probably the most famous example was the WTO protests in Seattle in 1999. Those were peaceful protests, and at some point, the police decided to fire tear gas on some protesters who were, you know, were trespassing. They were in a public street, but they weren't violent. And that spurred a series of riots that kind of spread all over the city. And the police chief at the time, a guy named Norm Stamper, says today that, he said initially that he supported the decision, took responsibility for it. Today he says it was the biggest mistake of his career because he says he's seen how our response to protests in America that's become kind of the template, that responding in the full, what he calls Darth Vader gear, is now sort of, you know, how cities, how local governments prepare for protest, which, you know, protest is people basically expressing the right to free speech and free assembly. And when, you know, the default response among police departments and city governments is, you know, that we are expecting violence and we are expecting confrontation, that has a pretty serious effect, a chilling effect on free speech.
So a flash forward to Ferguson, Missouri, over the past few days. What kind of gear are these police carrying? You mentioned a sniper, and you mentioned an armed personnel carrier, and talked about how they dehumanized themselves with this. How do they look?
Yeah, and this is something I actually just put a post up on at the Washington Post this morning. Interviewed a guy named Max Guerin, who's a lieutenant in the Dallas Police Department, who wrote a thesis on a police, how police should respond to protest. And he made the point that, you know, when it's one thing for police, law enforcement officials to dehumanize citizens, that's a problem. But what happens when all of your police officers look exactly the same, when they're hiding their faces and they're sort of, they look like robots? The officers themselves, they dehumanize themselves to the protesters. And so particularly if you're protesting police misconduct or alleged police misconduct, as we saw here, the protesters, they don't see, you know, humans on the other side of the protest line. What they see is a, you know, sort of robotic manifestation of everything that they're protesting against. And this, again, invites, you know, confrontation. When you discourage, you know, both sides from seeing one another as human beings, you set the stage for violence.
This has been an issue in the country for a long, long time. In 1965 in Los Angeles during the Watts riots, the police were described as an occupying army. That was also true in 1992 after the Rodney King riots. But they weren't armed and equipped quite the way we hear described in Ferguson and other recent incidents. What's happened?
Well, we've seen a dramatic increase in militarization of American police over the last 30 to 35 years, and it's been driven primarily by the drug war, and then again after the September 11th attacks, it's been exacerbated, I think, by the war on terror. And what we've seen is not just a militarization in terms of the gear and the outfits. You know, in Ferguson, you know, we see cops wearing camouflage, which, you know, in a town like Ferguson. One, the police aren't hiding in the first place. They want to be seen, but, you know, even if they were, they're not raiding forests, right? They're in an urban environment. It's to mimic the military. And so we're seeing an increase not just in the gear and the equipment, but also in the mentality, I think, in the mindset and how police officers view themselves. I reported last year, before all this happened in St. Louis County, a spokesman from the St. Louis County Police Department confirmed that they had a policy of serving every search warrant in the county with a SWAT team, regardless of the crime. You know, that SWAT was a kind of a level of force that was once reserved for emergency situations, you know, active shooter scenarios or bank robberies. In St. Louis County and in other jurisdictions now, it's become the default use of force for serving a search warrant, and I think that's concerning.
Are more officers veterans of recent wars?
They are. That's kind of a complicated issue. When I started researching my book, actually, I assumed that was a problem, that police officers, you know, veterans coming back and becoming police officers were, you know, might bring a kind of battlefield mentality to the job. But when I started actually interviewing police chiefs and police officials for the book, what I found is even among police chiefs who agree with me, who tend to be older and retired, but who agree sort of on the general that militarization is a problem and something to worry about, they actually said that veterans are actually a good influence on some of the rogue officers in their department. The military, you know, instills a kind of discipline, a sense of kind of self-responsibility. They do after-action reports where they review, you know, what just happened and what they can do better. And they said it actually, they think, you know, they're concerned about militarization, but they don't think that veterans returning from overseas is part of the problem.
And they know what a real danger looks like, I suppose, as well. What about race, particularly in Ferguson, which is a largely African-American town with a largely white police force? Does that play a role as well?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I think it also contributes to, again, this perception problem on both sides of the protest lines. You know, when a town or when a community doesn't see itself reflected in its police force, it's more likely to view the police as an occupying force or a force that's being imposed upon them instead of, you know, people, public servants who are drawn from their ranks and, you know, who occasionally use force to protect them. And from the police side, you know, if the police don't see themselves reflected in the people they serve, they're not likely to consider themselves part of that community, and instead they're likely to see themselves as enforcers. And I think, you know, it's pretty dramatic in Ferguson. I mean, when 52 out of 55 of the police officers are white and the community is 67% black, and you have, you know, 85 to 90% of the arrests and traffic stops and stop and frisks are of black people, that's a huge problem, and I think it makes something like what we're seeing now pretty inevitable.
And when you have situations like warrants being served by SWAT teams, is that more often likely to happen in African American and Latino communities than it is in white communities?
It is, but I think that's a product of just the fact that most of the criminal justice system's excesses are directed or end up affecting those communities. I don't think it's, you know, I don't think it's a sort of affirmative racism. I don't think they're deliberately targeting those communities because of their color, but I do think it's a product of a lot of the criminal justice system's excesses.
Radley Balko, once again, a blogger about criminal justice in the Washington Post, author of Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Forces. Great to have you with us. Thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.